Previously on Beta.
Coming out of the gate.
Oh, no. 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 No, 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 no.
Oh, God, that's so heartbreaking, Doug.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Beta is a polyphonic mosh pit where high culture and low culture collide. We take an immersive, innovative, playful, and provocative approach to exploring arts, culture, and technology. Today, we'll meet one of music's most prolific and creative artists, Amy Denial.
And he mumbles, well, I don't really know any songs. I'm an improviser. I'll try something. Certain parts of his brain light up when he does that.
And we'll celebrate the 10th anniversary of one of the greatest TV shows of all time, Breaking Bad.
You got a brain the size of Wisconsin, but we're not going to hold that against you.
Thanks for the compliment. Wait a second. That wasn't a compliment, was it? Are you making fun of us? Whatever. Let's kick things off with Joe Frank. If you've listened to a lot of public radio over the years, there's a good chance that you've heard of Joe Frank. But there's also a good chance you've never heard of him. Joe Frank is a legendary radio artist who transformed audio storytelling with his richly textured, mind-bending radio shows. These shows combined scripted drama, improv comedy, and intimate conversations. His work is unlike anybody else's, which is probably one of the reasons why he's not nearly as well known as he should be. Frank passed away in January at the age of 79. But while he was still alive, Chicago filmmaker Dave Carlson had a chance to interview him a few times. Carlson has made a new documentary called Joe Frank, Somewhere Out There. This American Life's Ira Glass, comedian David Cross, and actor-writer Harry Shearer are all fans of Joe Frank's iconic radio art.
Now let me tell you the truth. Joe Frank is a character that I created, who I pretend to be. But I'm not really Joe Frank. My life doesn't even remotely resemble Joe Frank's. Yet, what I'm saying now, the admission that I am not Joe Frank, has been written for me by Joe Frank.
Joe Frank is what radio in its wildest dreams wishes it could be. Ballsy, intelligent, thoughtful, dangerous. This is not standard NPR stuff. And I think what he explores a lot in his work is the way that words are used to obfuscate as opposed to clarify.
His work, right from when you first heard it back in the 80s, why did it strike such a chord with you?
Well, I think for me as a filmmaker, it was about the sound design. There's always the drone. You know, it gets you sort of like wrapped up in his headspace.
The drone is an important aspect in Joe's sound. I loved it when the music would stop and the drone would come up. Like a big, like this sort of strange foghorn. It's full of harmonics. They're really complex. He used to put them together with lots of different sounds. They add a sort of a strange dither.
Joe used to use two types of drones. One is a synthesizer pad consisting of three or four notes. And then we had this human choir, like ah or ooh, on the 8-track machine. That gave us the flexibility of choosing either one note on the drone or two notes on the drone or the fourth voice on the choir. Bam, people are locked in.
But the writing in itself, I mean, I think it, when I was younger, I didn't appreciate it as much, you know, maybe I took it for granted. And as I've gotten older, I've realized, wow, this guy could craft a story, and how he did it and how he researched this stuff and how he created these monologues were just mind-bending and beautiful. And so I think it was those elements, that sort of sound design element that not just wrap me, but I think wrap a lot of his listeners up.
Yeah. Can you tell me a bit about Joe Frank's childhood?
His family fled Europe when the Nazis started taking off from Poland. So they were refugees, and his father was way older than his mother. His mother was like 19. I think his dad was like in his 40s or something, or 50s.
Wow.
Yeah, and so it wasn't really a compatible relationship from what he told me. But his dad had a company called Langerman Shoe Company, and he was able to get financing when he moved to New York with the family in Manhattan and had a big business in the Empire State Building. He got a lot of his relatives out of Europe, so he was sort of the patriarch, I think, of the family. Unfortunately, Joe's dad died when he was like 5, I think, and his mother hid it from him at the same time Joe was getting an operation for his club feet. And so when he got out of the hospital, the mom kind of didn't tell him and then eventually did. And so about a year later, the mother married somebody who worked in the business. So he had a stepfather his whole life. There's a lot of stuff in the film that talks about how his mom and his stepfather's relationship wasn't very good either. It was not a very healthy one. And it created a lot of anxiety, I think, for him. And a lot of that developed in his work later.
And I'm wondering how much of this dark existential worldview came from his childhood?
Oh, I think a lot of it did. I think Larry Josephson, one of the other great radio guys who's in this picture, says that...
But he allows people to experience feelings that they wouldn't allow themselves to feel. I think that Hitler deserves a bit of credit for Joe Frank's success. The refugee experience shaped Joe's life and made him insecure. You know, were the Nazis going to come back? Would he go broke? Would he get sick? It all had to do with it.
I'm sitting at a dinner party attended by Pol Pot, Hitler, Stalin, and Mao. Seated at another smaller table are Saddam Hussein, Slobodan Milosevic, Pinochet, and some others that I don't recognize. And then there's a third table, sort of a children's table. It has shorter legs and smaller children's chairs. And sitting there are Richard Speck, Gary Gilmore, Jeffrey Dahmer, John Wayne Gacy, Ted Bundy, and Charlie Manson. Then we all get into a discussion concerning the selection of paint colors for the renovation of the kitchen. Hitler is partial to Bavarian cream, and Stalin interrupts, and he says he'd like to have a dacha effect with a checkered tablecloth, louvered shutters, gingham curtains. And then Paw Pot suggests little flower boxes for the windowsills, zinnias and daisies he thinks would be very cheerful. And then we talk about books.
When he passed away in January, you heard a lot of stuff in podcasts and you saw a lot of writings about him and stuff like that. And because podcasts are like the new thing nowadays, you know, he kind of blows a lot of people away who think they're doing innovative stuff now. I mean, all those types of things and the deep thoughts he put into his shows, and he did it on a weekly basis when he was doing his thing. I mean, it's amazing the amount of content he put out and how rigorous he was with his shows. I mean, they would literally be stringing them up minutes before they were being played live, so to speak. So his work ethic can't be beat.
Yeah, and that raises the question, because his radio work is so unique and so decidedly Joe Frank-esque, can you hear his influence in other public radio or audio programming? I don't think you can. Do you hear it anywhere?
Well, I'll tell you one thing where I heard it a few years ago. You know, I was sort of taken aback by it because it was so specific to me. And a lot of times when people say, Joe Frank, you know, who's that? Because there's 50% of the people who know precisely who this cat is, and there's 50% who don't. And the people who don't, you have to explain, like, who is he, you know? And Alexander Payne says in my movie, just listen, you know, because it's hard to sort of wrap your head around it. But what I do to people, and this is to answer your question, is I say, are you familiar with Dos Equis, The Most Interesting Man in the World? And they all go, yeah. I go, okay, you know the sound design on that where a guy's listing great achievements and there's looped music and it's hypnotic and it's funny and it's surreal and it's trippy? That's Joe Frank.
He wouldn't be afraid to show his feminine side if he had one. His mother has a tattoo that reads, son. At museums, he's allowed to touch the art. He is the most interesting man in the world.
Stay thirsty, my friends.
In fact, he has a show called An Enterprising Man. Mm. If you listen to it, it sounds a lot like the Dos Equis commercials. So I mentioned that pop culture reference. People kind of understand it. And then they sometimes some of them go like, oh, yeah, I know that guy. I've heard him on BEZ or something like that.
I'm curious about why Joe Frank isn't more well known. It seems to me that a lot of that might have to do with the fact that his work was so groundbreaking, so original, and so dark and existential. Maybe it was just too intense for some people to handle. What do you think?
I think you're on the right track with that. So the people who, the 50% who know him, usually there's 1% that know him and they go, no, thank you. And it's for the reasons I think they talked about. You know, sometimes he brings up things about the human condition that maybe people would rather keep to themselves and not have to have somebody tell them it, you know, because it can be a little bit alarming, disarming, intense sometimes when he gets going. I see it as sort of like a good art film. You know, I can go to see lots of great art films and everybody wants to go to the multiplex zone and see the junk. So it's a safe zone, I think, for people to maybe not open themselves up to his work.
I remember one of the shows, my favorite one, from the helicopter, the traffic report over L.A., and it's just these horrific accidents and you don't know what is the angle. It takes 15 minutes to figure out. Oh, I see. He's talking about the apocalypse and Jesus coming back and Armageddon. And it's like lobster dipped in butter. It's just delicious and good for you. It's not good for you, but, you know.
On the westbound 101 around Topanga Canyon, we have a spill of high-level biohazard waste materials cordoning off the entire neighborhood of Woodland Hills. And there appears to be a drive-by shooting gone terribly wrong on the 210 westbound at Vernon. CHP converging on that area. And at the Corona Expressway out in Chino Hills at Grand Avenue, a hot air balloon has been ensnared in a high-tension wire, and the gondola appears to be melting. Its inhabitants apparently incinerated. So there's a lot of rubbernecking that's slowing things down all the way to Riverside Avenue. And you might want to avoid that.
I think Joe is a perfect example of the kind of person who understands the work that you have to generate yourself and figure out every step of yourself. His shows, there was nothing like really what he did. He just forged a new genre, his own.
What do you think is Joe Frank's legacy?
You know, one of the lines that's in the movie, I think, and I think a lot of people just say, is the term human condition. You know, he was sort of a master of capturing the human condition in his own way, whether it was through his own life or through other people's lives. I think he was, you know, he was a one of a kind in that way.
Mm-hmm. What do you hope people take away from watching Joe Frank somewhere out there?
That's a good question. I think he was a guy who never compromised. And I think when anybody does their art, I think he's a role model for that. Or he's one of the guys who didn't compromise in anything he did. And he, like Grace said, he forged his own genre. And I think that, you know, that's a tough thing to do in any art form. He's sort of the gold standard, I think, for somebody who pursued something that creative that he wanted to do and blew most people out of the water while doing it.
It's odd. You don't experience your own death. The last thing you experience is the last moment of your life. When you die, you have no idea that you just died. If you suddenly die at home, your friends and relatives grieve and cry and embrace. It's very emotional. It's a tragedy. You're gone. But at the same time, you're not completely gone, because your body is still lying on the floor of your apartment. It's as if you've gone off on a trip from which you'll never return and left an unseemly mess behind. And that mess is you.
Dave Carlson is the director of Joe Frank, Somewhere Out There. If you're interested in finding out more about Joe Frank's groundbreaking radio art, the film screens at the Wisconsin Film Festival on Wednesday, April 11th. For more information, visit our website at wpr.org/beta. We'd love to hear what you think of the show. And you can email us at beta@wpr.org.
The chorus is Piti plakati sniti, to drink, to cry, to dream, to learn, to love, to fly. So I just thought, that's great. Piti plakati sniti.
Coming up next, the remarkably creative and productive musician Amy Denial joins us on Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome back to Beta. I'm Doug Gordon. Musician Amy Denial has accomplished many things over the course of her 32-year career. She's worked with people like avant-rock guitarist Fred Frith and also the pioneering electronic art music composer Pauline Oliveras. But one of the most remarkable things about Denial is that she's done exactly whatever she's wanted to do throughout her career. That's no easy task. She's also been named one of rock's 10 smartest, strongest women. Her latest CD is called The Big Embrace. Denial tells us what inspires her.
I'm influenced by everything that enters my ears, whether I like it or not. And that could be garbage trucks in Taiwan that play Fur Elise. It's pretty funny. And so people, when they hear that melody, they run out with their garbage. And it's electronic. It's hilarious. Pretty much everything. I mean, I love noise. I love just sounds you find in the environment. I do a lot of field recording.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, on the Laborazione, it actually starts, there are these two very sad dogs down the street, and they sing in harmony. They actually wail. I don't think they're very happy.
Oh, dear.
I guess they're huskies. I thought they were hound dogs. They were doing their thing, and I thought, oh, I have to record them. It's just the most mournful sound. And then it turned out that they were singing in tune with my bratsch. So I said, oh, I have to use it on the song. That's great.
So the opening song on The Big Embrace is called L'Abbraccione. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
L'Abbraccione, that's perfect.
Yeah, no, yours is perfect. You have the energy and the vibrato and everything because you have the lovely four-octave range voice. So that's got to be an Italian word.
It is. It means the big embrace of all things.
Ah, so it would be fair to consider this the title track, would it not?
Yeah, it is. And the reason why I called it that is because I'm playing a Croatian mandolin-type instrument called the bratsch. And so I thought, well, gee, what rhymes with bratsch? I can't, abbraccio. So, and I don't know, abbraccione, because it's actually a little tiny instrument. So I thought, ironically, okay, I'll just call it the big embrace.
So can you tell me a bit about this song?
Well, I had been lent this instrument because I'm working on an opera with some really amazing people, including Gino Jevjevic from Culture Shock, who's originally from Sarajevo, Bosnia, Herzegovina. We did an opera on Nikola Tesla. We were presenting the first act last June, and so I'd been lent this 100-year-old little tiny mandolin thing called bratsch. And it just told me one day, it's like, you need to record me. You need to create something with me. And so I just came up with this really easy riff, and then I just kept adding layers and layers, and I thought, well, maybe I should add some voice, so I did.
There are four songs on the new album that start with RX, which is, of course, the Latin symbol for prescription.
Mm-hmm.
Prescription for the Wife and Prescription for a Scrambled Egg and Peanut Butter are two of them. And my personal favorite is Prescription for the Afterlife. Can you tell me a bit about that one?
Sure. I wrote that song thinking about, and also Prescription for the Wife. The wife is actually a real person in my life who's my best friend for about 30 years. And she went through breast cancer and had a really long run of battling it for about 5 years, and it was really difficult for her. I wrote all those recipes in one day because I thought, what am I going to do today? I know. And I was staring at the cookbooks in the kitchen. I said, oh, I'm going to write a bunch of recipes. That's what I'll do.
Use your imagination. apart, sound sparkle alive. The afterlife is gonna be alright. All the sounds that I've heard will boil down to one big
Do you believe in an afterlife?
I think that when we cease suffering in our current mortal coils, that we're going to be immersed in the most grand sound vibration possible. That's going to be, you know, basically, who knows what that's going to be. So I can't really imagine a physical place or something like that.
All the sounds that I've heard will boil down to one big.
One of your most famous albums, of course, is Tongues, which came out in 1993. And this album features you singing in various languages, English, French, Italian, Czech, Russian, Greek, and your own invented language, which I'd like to refer to as Denioese, but I don't know. You probably have a better name for it.
No, that's it. Vocalalia.
Okay, Vocalalia is nice. So why did you decide to sing in all these different languages?
I discovered that I love language around that time. I think it started with inviting some Russian musicians, jazz musicians, to come to Seattle to perform at the Goodwill Games in 1990. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I better learn some Russian.
Yeah.
You know, and so I got the Berlitz book of Russian. And then I thought the best way to learn language is through song. So I thought, I'll just write a song in Russian. So I did. And the song's called Da. And the subtitle is Gdzie Damskaya Parkmarkirskaya. I don't say it very often, so that came out. Anyway, and I chose phrases out of this phrase book that sort of made sense as lyrics. So the translation is, I cannot find my wife. Please show me on the map. When will she be back? Give me a schedule. So I thought, this is really fun. And because I was traveling quite a lot in Europe, my band, the Tone Dogs, were headed over to the Czech Republic for the first time, 1 year exactly to the day after the Velvet Revolution. And I thought, quick, I have 6 weeks. I should write a song in Czech. So I got a Czech book and wrote a song in Czech that called Checkered Pajamas. And people were just weeping when we played it. They said, you're actually attempting to speak our language. That's amazing.
What is that song about?
Again, it's from a phrase book, so it's like, good morning, please speak slowly, we are strangers here, lighter, shorter, smaller, darker. The fun part was that the chorus is a string of all infinitives, all verbs. Piti plakati sniti, like to drink, to cry, to dream, to learn, to love, to fly.
Yeah.
So I just thought, that's great. Piti plakati sniti, you know what I'm saying?
I think I read that it's also about asking the waiter to put more appetizers in the train station baggage room. Is that correct?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. It's cool because, for one thing, taking lyrics using a phrase book, it reminds me of that famous Monty Python sketch where John Cleese is playing this guy and he's reading out of a book and he's saying, my hovercraft is full of eels and things like that.
My hovercraft is full of eels.
Also, these outlandish storylines you have, they're very Kafka-esque,
well,
which is especially appropriate for the Czech song.
Indeed.
So you sing these songs in different languages using phrase books. Then you take things to the next level by inventing your own language.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you want to do that?
Well, I think that I'm trying to think of who would have influenced me. I just always loved the concept of improvising with my voice, and so it came naturally, having been exposed to people like Ella Fitzgerald.
Mm-hmm. What about people like, you know, over the years there have been several artists who have created their own fictional languages, which they used in their music, people like Lambert Hendrickson Ross,
right.
John LaBarbera, David Moss, Theodore Monk, and Slim Gaylard. Have any of these people influenced you?
Yes, David Moss is a good friend of mine. Also, Meredith Monk, I loved what she did with the extending the potential of the human voice, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think I was just exposed to most of the people that you mentioned, and I just found that almost more interesting and certainly less literal than working with language. And, you know, music anyway, it crosses all borders, and it's got such a great communicative background and foreground and trajectory that I feel like, in a way, you can make more sense without words. That'll reach more people.
Yeah, and isn't it also maybe part of the appeal, it just occurred to me while you were talking, that maybe also the other thing is that it gets the listener more involved because it kind of serves as, for lack of a better term, an audio Rorschach blot that they can bring their own meaning and interpretation to it?
That's really true. I have a funny example of that. I have an old song of mine I wrote in 1984 that it's called When George Bush Was Head of the CIA. It was all done on four-track, and so I thought, well, I'll go into the bathroom because the acoustics are a little better. And I flipped the tape over, and I sang this melody, and then when I flipped it over so it was running forward, it was do 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 do. And the way I sing it, when I would sing it live, sort of like that, however the tones would come out most easily, people would come up to me after having heard that song and saying, that song about your father was really intense. So all these different people had really different interpretations of what I... And I was just kind of going, la, 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 dee, 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 doo, doo, you know. But people instantly assumed it meant something and found meaning in it, which I think is great.
Do you have a favorite song from Tongues, one that features your own invented language?
Well, I don't have the album in front of me, so I can't remember what it's called. I love all the little excerpts.
Are you familiar with the idea of speaking in tongues, which is part of the Pentecostalism faith, the idea that a believer may vocalize these fluent, unintelligible languages?
Absolutely, yeah.
Speaking in tongues, has that influenced your fictional language at all in any way?
I'm sure that it has, because really, when I improvise, I'm the happiest. When I shut up, logical part of brain, when I you know, turn off the lights over there and just let go, I find that I'm really happy. And that kind of reminds me, I just saw this really great, interesting film, anyway, called The Act of God, and it's a film about people hit by lightning and how it affects their brains and how they see fate and everything. And Fred Frith does a soundtrack, and he's actually part of the movie, too, in which he goes into this laboratory in London, and they affix some kind of helmet to his head with bunches of sensors to measure his brain waves, and they say, okay, go ahead and play a song, you know. And he mumbles, well, I don't really know any songs. I'm an improviser. I'll try something. Certain parts of his brain light up when he does that. He figures out something that he kind of knows. And then they say, okay, now go ahead and improvise. And his entire brain lights up.
Hmm.
It's very different. So when I'm improvising vocally, that's what's happening. That is going into the zone, and I'm sure that happens similarly with athletes or whoever has that potential to stop rational thinking and simply act from intuition.
Interesting.
Yeah.
One of your many side projects is this group called the Tipton Sax Quartet, formerly known as the Billy Tipton Memorial Quartet. You're a founding member of this group. Who was Billy Tipton?
Billy Tipton was born Dorothy Lucille Tipton, and at a certain point began to play saxophone, and at a certain point went to an audition. And they said, you play well, but you don't get the job. And she really wanted to play in that band and decided to come again a month later, having cut her hair and dressing up as a man and taking her brother's name, Billy. And so she came back to the audition for this same group a month later.
Hi, I'm Billy. I'm Dorothy's brother.
And she got the job. So from that moment on, she said, okay, I'm going to cross-dress and live as a man, and was an accomplished musician, piano player and saxophone player, and eventually became a booking agent based in Spokane. I've met a bunch of musicians who he booked. When I found out that story, I'd already been playing, you know, we'd started the sax quartet of all women a year before, and we had a very regrettable name. It was Flemme Fatale. And so when we discovered the story of Billy Tipton, we thought, here's someone who's following their path and has the courage to follow their path and not toe the line of the expectations of society, but rather do what they feel they're destined to do. And so that's why we decided to name our group the Billy Tipton Memorial Saxophone Quartet, in honor of someone who took a lot of risks, and it was not easy. It's not an easy life that Billy had.
Don't you have a member in your group that in the Tipton Sax Quartet? Isn't there a member from Wisconsin?
Yes. One of the best sax players in Wisconsin / the U.S. / probably the world, whose name is Sue Orfield. And she lives in Eau Claire. And she's my hero. She's just a gem of a person, and it was one of the most accomplished and inventive and beautiful and soulful sax players I've ever heard. So I'm honored to play with her because she's always teaching me something. I love it.
That's the inimitable, innovative Amy Denial. To find out more about Amy and to hear more of her music, visit wpr.org/beta. We'd love to hear what you think of Beta. You can get in touch with us by sending an email to beta@wpr.org.
I think what happens to the American dream of progress in Breaking Bad is that it shifts to the underworld.
We celebrate the 10th anniversary of one of the greatest TV series of all time, Breaking Bad, right after this. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome back to Beta. I'm Doug Gordon. 10 years ago, Vince Gilligan and his creative team introduced Breaking Bad into the television universe and into our homes. The AMC hit series about a chemistry teacher turned drug kingpin quickly found a large and devoted audience.
Do you know how much I make a year? I mean, even if I told you, you wouldn't believe it. Do you know what would happen if I suddenly decided to stop going into work? A business big enough that it could be listed on the NASDAQ goes belly up. Disappears. It ceases to exist without me. No, you clearly don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
Gilligan provided a storyline that was as addictive as its subject matter. But there's a lot more to the show than a compelling narrative. Breaking Bad broke new ground with visionary storytelling, from luscious long shots of the borderland landscapes to the fisheye point of view camera. Breaking Bad's aesthetic captured the contemporary Southwest in a beautiful and provocative way. And let's not forget the show's cold opens. They offered an opportunity to introduce new narrative devices, including a fake TV commercial, disorienting black-and-white flash-forwards, and even a fully produced music video for a faithful recreation of a narco corrido. Cordelia Barrera is an assistant professor at Texas Tech University. She specializes in Latina and Latino literature. In her essay, Negro y Azul, the Narco Corrido Goes Gothic, Barrera argues that this particular cold open encapsulated the show's unique spin on the classic American Gothic.
The opening scene is a music video, just over 3 minutes long, sung by Los Cuates de Sinaloa.
La ciudad se llama Duke, Nuevo México, el estado.
A band originally from Sinaloa, Mexico, now based in Phoenix, Arizona.
Entre la gente mafiosa, su fama se ha propagado, causa de una nueva droga que los gringos han creado.
The video, titled Negro y Azul, which means black and blue, is about a, quote, gringo boss named Heisenberg, who is disrespecting the Mexican drug cartel by cornering the Albuquerque market with high-quality blue crystal meth.
What did you think of this scene the first time you saw it?
The first time I saw the video, I laughed. I laughed out loud. I thought, this is perfect. I had been wanting to write something about what I believed were the gothic elements of the show, but I hadn't been able to conceptualize what I wanted to say. So when I saw the video and subsequently watched it again and again and looked closely at the lyrics, I knew I had the framing device that I needed. As a grad student in Latina literature, I'd studied corridos, so I immediately knew what Negro y Azul was. I also knew that positioning Heisenberg, Walter White's alter ego, in the series as a protagonist in the corrido was extraordinary. He's a white male, and the subjects of corridos and even narco corridos are never white males.
Mm. And as you mentioned, the song is performed by a real corrido band. What does corrido mean?
Yeah, so corridos are traditional folk songs or ballads, indigenous, localized products that memorialize culture heroes. They're oral poems that present an event from its own time. Traditional corridos celebrate and eulogize the heroic values of the proletariat, people whose principal offense was a response to an oppressive social system. The word comes from the verb correr, which means to run. And the term itself reflects an ongoing or running account of a story recited in plain verse. There's a really important Mexican-American scholar named Américo Paredes who wrote a book called With His Pistol in His Hand. And this was first published in 1958. And basically what he wrote about was the story of Gregorio Cortés. And there's been a movie made about this as well. He was a famous border hero who was falsely accused of murder by the Texas Rangers in 1901. Now, he was forced to flee his South Texas home and fight for his rights, quote, with a pistol in his hand.
En el condado del Carmen, miren lo que ha sucedido. Murió el sheriffe mayor, quedando Román herido.
Now, this is very different from the narco corrido, right?
Yes.
Most scholars agree that the narco corrido, which translates as drug ballad, evolved out of the corrido form. But its lyrics are different. Its lyrics are often violent, sometimes overtly so, and its situations are not localized, but detail a globalized world of commerce and a global marketplace, in which the tenor of conflict shifts from the peaceful, everyday subject forced to take up arms to defend family, social, or cultural values to the narco trafficker. So the heroes of narco corridos, and we can put this term in quotes, are more like anti-heroes. They're these morally ambiguous figures who lack conventional heroic qualities, such as morality or ethical codes based in idealism. A lot of times these narcos are outrageously self-serving.
You've talked a bit about this already, but can you talk a bit more about what the lyrics of the song say?
Yeah, so the song Negro y Azul positions not Walt, but his alter ego, Heisenberg, as the protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've talked about this. Protagonists of narco corridos are generally unscrupulous Mexican or Latino narco traffickers, these anti-heroes, drug lords, high-ranking members of drug cartels, who glory in orchestrating violent and often grisly stratagems of generally masculine power and authority. And the narco corrido Negro y Azul follows the traditional corrido structure in that we're given a prologue to the story itself, and then a moral and a farewell, the despedida, right?
Mm-hmm.
With regards to Walt's alter ego, Heisenberg, the song positions him as a dead man walking. The lyrics read, in translation, the cartel's running hot because they were disrespected. They talk about some Heisenberg who now controls the market. No one knows a thing about him since they have never seen him. The cartel's about respect, and they have never forgiven. This homie's already dead. He just hasn't been told so.
Nadie sabe nada de él, porque nunca lo han mirado a la furia del cartel. Nadie jamás ha escapado, ese compa ya está muerto. No más no le han avisado.
I think the introduction of this song in season two is really significant because it foreshadows Heisenberg's and thus Walt's eventual demise, his death. What's more significant is that Walt slash Heisenberg is a white man, and again, he's the subject of this narco corrido. And this just doesn't happen. So if we encapsulate the setting, the landscape of this song within the broader context of a series that I believe outlines and details the disintegration of white male authority in the American West. We see how this song becomes an ironic farewell that foreshadows the continuing disintegration of the white male patriarch and speaks to the fragility of white masculine authority on the 21st century borderlands.
So there is this turf war that is reflected in this narco corrido, this conflict between two different cultures. Not fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. At the simplest level, what you have in Breaking Bad is a turf war. So as Walt slash Heisenberg and his accomplices jockey for absolute control of the available resources and capital to be had in the regional meth trade, they play out a story aligned with much of Western history. Theirs is a contest for dominance charged with the drawing of lines and border disputes that really, in the end, fuse the roles of victim and villain. And this is why I argue that this series overall has the feel of a frontier gothic. In the series, you've got this convergence of cultures and people in a hostile, contested borderlands landscape. And then you've got these gothic elements, these psychological hauntings, double, secrets and lies, imprisonment, crawl spaces. Yeah. And most importantly, a suburban sterility that plays upon our suspicions that even the most ordinary house or family has something to hide. What we see here is that we've got the transformation of this Western landscape into this kind of tragic, maybe even a fallen space in the wake of white settlement and globalizing forces.
Yeah. I love that phrase, suburban sterility. In your essay, you say that in early American Gothic writing, indigenous cultures are doomed to extinction when white settlers arrive. But that isn't really quite what's happening in Breaking Bad, is it?
So if we look at American Gothic, which is really different from European forms, we can see how these narratives are deeply engaged with historical concerns, notably horrors such as Native American massacres and the legacy of American slavery that continue to haunt the stories we tell about ourselves, the stories that make national identity possible. In the American West, a term like frontier Gothic relates to how repressed or even silenced regional horrors speak to the dispossession or removal of Native Americans, to expose the artificial or imaginary foundations on which American identities are precariously balanced. And what I mean by artificial or imaginary foundations is that, you know, these are the stories that we tell about ourselves. Stories of manifest destiny and American exceptionalism. So when we look at Walt slash Heisenberg's story through the lens of this song, Negro y Azul, we see that it's the white male who's doomed to perish. Walt has no future in this new landscape. The New Mexico desert and suburban Albuquerque that factors so heavily in Walt's transformation signify a uniquely American landscape. And the range and power of the frontier is found in the promise that Americans can get away from everything that they have and are, that they have been and are. This promise is an escape from the confinements of a civilization associated with old world European values, but it's ultimately an escape from self. So in the pilot episode, when we see Walt's brother-in-law, DEA agent Hank Schrader. And he shows Walt this drug bust in New Mexico, in New Mexico desert, that yields over $700,000. A seed's planted in Walt. Mm-hmm. And we see his transformation begin to take shape pretty quickly.
Hey, Walt, come here, everybody, listen up, listen up, listen up. I'm gonna give a little toast. A little toast to my brother-in-law. Come here. Walt, you got a brain the size of Wisconsin, but we're not gonna hold that against you. But your heart's in the right place, man. Your heart's in the right place. We love you, man. We love you. Everybody, to Walt, Nostrovia.
Nostrovia.
Turn on channel 3.
At which point, we apprehended three individuals and placed them into custody. Clearly an ongoing operation, one which was well-organized.
Hank, how much money is that?
It's about 700 grand. It's a pretty good haul.
As I say, it's a good day for the citizens of Albuquerque when we can put this big a dent in the local drug trade.
But that's unusual, isn't it? That kind of cash?
Well, it's not the most we ever took. It's easy money till we catch you. Walt, just say the word, and I'll take you on a ride-along. You can watch us knock down a meth lab. Get a little excitement in your life.
Yeah, someday.
Breaking Bad really is redefining the idea of the American dream, isn't it?
Yeah. So I think what happens to the American dream of progress in Breaking Bad is that it shifts to the underworld. The show is preoccupied with the nature of change, chemical changes certainly, but more significantly, a changing American landscape that foregrounds suburban sterility and a global market economy that has left many formerly secure middle-class Americans anguished and often desperate. Walt regains his masculine authority, something we feel he's lost when we first meet him. What we have to remember is that Walt's manhood and masculine white authority are not regained in the domestic, urban, or even the suburban sphere. He regains his authority within the globalized world of commerce and the new marketplace of the war on drugs. But his rise to power is as short-lived and excessively violent as all narcos.
Yeah, as you say, self-actualization. He reaches the top of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and then he is a man of action. He doesn't just daydream and think about, oh, I should do this. You know, in the pilot, he's such a sad sack. His life is at the lowest point. He's, disrespected by his high school chemistry class students, and he's working in the car wash part-time and treated poorly by his boss before he quits. Yeah, he's someone who does something, I think, that a lot of us aren't willing to do and actually take action.
Right. He feeds his shadow, strengthening it with all the horrors that the 21st century borderlands can deliver. And I think that this makes him a frightening but also a very attractive figure.
Cordelia Barrera is the author of the essay Negro y Azul, The Narco Querido Goes Gothic. Her essay is featured in the book Breaking Down, Breaking Bad. We thought it would be cool to have our own beta narco querido. And of course, we have very deep pockets, so money is no object. Who are we kidding? Money is definitely an object which is totally out of our reach. So we had to get creative, but that's what beta does best. And because we spared every possible expense, we came up with not one, but two beta narco queridos. And of course, we had some disagreements about which version we should use. So we're going to let you, the listener, decide which beta narco querido we should play. Listen carefully and then drop us an email, beta@wpr.org. Here's number one.
No necesitarás narcóticos para disfrutar de beta. Beta es un alto natural. Porque los primeros 5 días después del fin de semana son los más difíciles.
Tres cosas rodas que pesan salvaron mi vida.
And here's number 2.
You will not require any narcotics to enjoy beta. Beta is a natural high. because the first 5 days after the weekend are the hardest.
Let us know which version you prefer. Contact us at beta@wpr.org.
Cuando las serpientes evolucionaron, más rápido que muchos venenos. Noten la diferencia entre una serpiente venenosa y otra que no lo es, por las marcas que deja.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our technical director and music director, Steve Gotcher.
Oh, wow! It's starting to even look like a triple rainbow.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
It's a bear! No!
It's right there.
Join us again next week. Beta, because the first 5 days after the weekend are the hardest. Until next time, I'm Doug Gordon.
Is this cap cool, square, or way out?
Thank you for listening. Okay, I think we're all done.
We're done. When I say we're done.